Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of November 11th, 2011. 11, 11, 11. This hour, we join forces with the New York Times to bring you stories about home ownership and where it fits in today's American dream.
I'm not looking to buy another house, probably ever. I'm going to live within my means and kind of start from scratch.
It wouldn't have been possible for either of us to purchase this property without pulling the resources.
Little did we know that within 24 months after we bought this place, this whole artificial bubble would explode.
It's been 3 years since the housing bubble burst, and those years have prompted a lot of soul searching by homeowners.
You're waiting months, and I'm like, oh, they're going to kick us out of our house.
It's just a different asset class that we think will go up in value.
My thinking about home ownership has totally changed in terms of its role in a financial plan. It's not an investment. It's a place you live.
Stay tuned for our special report, Which Way Home, on Marketplace Money from APM American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
Owning your own home has always been an element of the American dream. Few assets loom larger in our lives, both financially and emotionally. Today, in collaboration with the New York Times, we'll break down the numbers and the feelings behind home ownership from the perspective of those who own them, those who want to, and some who've lost them over the last 5 years. Let's start with some thoughts from the streets of L.A.
My name is Brearley Khan. We got a loft unit in a building that had previously gone bankrupt, and we were able to get a really good deal on it and a really good mortgage rate. But I do sometimes feel like you're taking advantage of other people's misfortune.
Daniel Passage, Long Beach. We just bought our home in 2004, and we've just paid it off. Because of paranoia about what's going on with the economy, we wanted to get in a situation where we knew we could never end up being homeless, no matter what happened with my job.
My name is Belinda Roberson-Trenord. I'm a native of Los Angeles. I would love to buy a home. I just can't afford it here. In 2008, I was glad I didn't buy one. We were looking at one, my husband and I, but we're very glad we didn't buy a home.
Eric Kowalski. Just bought my house about 2.5 years ago here in Highland Park. I know the home situation is still tough. You know, I think it's going to get better. I mean, home ownership is one of the American dreams.
Jonathan Barker. I live in Echo Park. This is with my wife, our first home. It's a big process, nerve-wracking, but we love our house. It's just nice to have a house as opposed to an apartment. You get a yard, and now we have a dog.
A few voices from around Los Angeles. Ron Lieber joins us now. He is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times. Glad to have you back on the program.
Good to be here.
So what we're taking a look at is the question of where housing now fits into the American dream. Has it always been a part of that?
I think you could safely say for at least roughly the last 30 or 40 years, people felt like owning their own little tiny piece of America is part of what it meant to be a successful American.
That has changed, perhaps, over the last 3 or 4 years with the collapse of the housing market. Let's talk a little bit about why we are addressing the housing question today.
Well, the biggest reason to address it is because more often than not, and just, sort of forget the last 5 years for a minute, the home and all of the equity in it is often your biggest asset by the time you're in your 50s or 60s. You've paid a lot of money towards it. Maybe you've paid it off entirely. Maybe you own it free and clear, and it's an asset that you can use to borrow against or to live in, rent free, or to sell and downsize to take some money off the table for your retirement and move in someplace smaller.
And I think what we're going to hear a lot during this hour and that we read in the New York Times special is that part of the big problem that we saw over the last decade or two was that we started to think about it as an asset that was an investment more than anything else, more than being somewhere to live. And that's really what got us in trouble.
Right. When people start to think about it in terms of an investment, they think of it as something that, grows at a certain rate of appreciation each year, something that you can buy and sell and trade. And, until 4 or 5 years ago, we never thought of homes as something that you could sort of flip over and, trade to somebody else and that would go up by 10% a year the way that stocks might in a good year. But the moment that that started to happen for people, they began to treat their homes in different ways. And it started to feel like it made sense to borrow more money to acquire that asset because it was going to go up so quickly that you just pay the loan back and keep going or, sell it before the bill came due.
So what has all this meant to the home, particularly home ownership, as part of the American dream? I know we're going to hear a lot about that in this hour, but what kind of conclusions can we draw from the reporting that we've done?
Well, I think it's tempting to take a look at what's happened in the last 5 years and say the American dream is dead and we've minted a nation of renters and, you know, people in their 20s and 30s who have seen the carnage who are thinking about buying, or people in their 40s and 50s who fell victim to it in some way, shape or form are never going to own homes again as long as they live. But I think it would be a mistake to draw that conclusion. Here's the problem we tend to have mentally when something extraordinary happens and it lasts for a long time. I mean, we tend to think that, wow, this time is different. This changes everything. We're never going to go back to the way we were before. And we've achieved some kind of, you know, permanent alteration in the human condition, or at least the way that humans analyze this particular condition. But let's get real here, right? The home is a great form of forced savings. You have to make the mortgage payment each and every month. Some of it goes towards principal, though not very much at first, but that goes up over time. And you're sort of forced to do it. So it's useful in that respect, as long as you're not buying at the tippy top of the market, which is what happened to people who bought in 2005 or 2006.
Ron Lieber writes the Your Money column for the New York Times, our collaborator on this program today. Thanks so much, Ron.
Thank you.
Bernie and Joyce Murphy are still convinced that they did everything right when they bought their home. And by all indications, they did. 4 years ago, the couple, who have been married 41 years, moved from a small town in Ohio to Stallings, North Carolina, just outside Charlotte.
All righty, we will get you some water here.
You look like a country girl. Already she looks like she fits right in.
Well, I'll take that as a compliment.
No, please do.
The Southern hospitality started there in their lovely two-story townhome and lasted through breakfast treats and several cups of coffee.
Now, we're very informal here, so what I'm going to do is probably just set everything on the table. All right, let me see here. I'm going to grind these up.
Bernie Murphy is 65 and retired. He spent two decades in state government in Ohio and another two before that working at a university. Joyce is 64 and works full-time as an administrative assistant at a private school. They saved up, put 5% down on their $160,000 townhome, and got themselves a plain vanilla 30-year mortgage.
Little did we know that within 24 months after we bought this place, that this whole artificial bubble would explode.
A recent appraisal put the home's current value at $125,000. They owe $148,000. They are now underwater. And based on what's happening around their housing development, the worst may be yet to come. We headed out for a walk around the neighborhood. A small creek runs through the tree-lined development where model homes have names like River Birch and Magnolia.
This is a unit here that went for 50 cents on the dollar.
Just three doors down from you?
Yeah.
Do you have any sense of how many of these homes might have been either foreclosure or...
I know that one. I think this one up here is a foreclosure. Hi there.
Those homes are now pulling down the price of the Murphys. What that means, they say, is that if they wanted to sell tomorrow, even next year, it's not likely they could. Not that they want to move anytime soon. In fact, their plan was to stay in these 1,700 square feet for another decade or so before moving to a retirement community. But their planning for this move was so thorough, they even weighed whether to get a home with stairs.
Normally, people our age or my age wouldn't buy a two-story because you'd never know when your knees are going to go or whatever. You know, and steps can kill you, okay? I mean, steps can be hazardous. Our plan was hold on to it 7 to 10 years, get rid of it. That is out the window now, because I can't get my money back in 7 to 10.
But for all their frustration, they will not join the ranks of those who walk away from their underwater mortgages. Joyce Murphy, who manages the family accounts, says it doesn't make any sense to them.
If you walk away, then what do you have? I mean, you know, you would be in worse shape than you are if you just sit there and take it, you know, basically.
What are the thoughts that go through your head when you write that mortgage check?
Well, I just try not to think about it.
But in many cases, the math argues that it doesn't make sense to stay in the house. Brent White teaches law at the University of Arizona. He says this is simple contract law. You either pay the mortgage or the bank takes the house. So underwater homeowners should make what seems like a fairly simple financial decision.
If they don't default on their mortgage, they're going to pour their disposable income into a toxic asset, not have money to retire, and perhaps not have money to put food on the table. On the other hand, if they default on their mortgage, they find that they let go of hundreds of thousands of dollars of bad debt, and they're able to get back on their feet and to recover.
Of course, it's rarely that simple. Emotional and psychological factors play into the decision to walk away just as much as financial ones. And a default can lead to a serious whack to your credit score. Fair Isaac, which provides the industry standard FICO credit score, released a study this year showing that scores drop by an average of 100 points or more after a foreclosure. The Murphys say being underwater does mean they've had to go to financial plans B and C, but they're quick to say others have it much worse than they do.
God love them, the people that make the decision to walk away, they're suffering because that goes against everything they have ever been taught. It goes against the entire national psyche.
And the family that we saw walk away here,
yeah,
they were devastated.
They were so embarrassed.
They
went in the middle of the night.
The Murphys can't afford their monthly mortgage payment, but because they can no longer count on making money when they do sell the house, they're changing their lifestyle to save more for the future. They hang on to a hope that the market will recover someday. And for Joyce, it's also about loving where she lives.
When you're writing that check, even though you know you're underwater, you know you're writing it for your home. It's still your home.
Technically, of course, it's not. The bank owns it in full when someone has no equity or negative equity. But that sentiment may be what allows homeownership to stay part of the American dream, a shift away from the house as investment mentality that persisted during the bubble.
We may have to live here for a long, long time, but you know what? I got that patio out there. I got that gas grill, you know, and I'm just, if you can't get your hands around it, why sit and pull your hair out over it?
And be sure to check out our website for extra coverage from this special, including an interactive housing map at marketplace.org/money. And you can find the print edition of our coverage at nytimes.com/whichwayhome.
Tell them that the house is not for sale. We're still living here. How come nobody can tell? We're taking all the furniture, moving our fate. Call my little honey, put your head on my knee. Tell them that the house is not for sale.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. And this week, in a special partnership with the New York Times that we're calling Which Way Home, we explore how housing fits into today's American dream. One of the changes we're seeing in homeownership out of the financial crisis is the return of multiple generations under one roof. The Pew Research Center says a record 49 million Americans live in this arrangement, up from 42 million in the year 2000. New York Times reporter Tara Siegel-Bernard visited one family in Raleigh, North Carolina, to see how it plays in their American dream.
Hello.
Hi, are you Wanda?
I am.
Nice to meet you,
Tara. Come on in.
Wanda Urbanska is a 55-year-old single mother who works as a media consultant and author. Last year, Wanda went to Poland to reconnect with her cousins and to finish a writing project. But that meant she'd have to leave behind her elderly mother, Marie Whitaker. Marie was 89 years old and lived alone.
I was concerned about leaving Mom because she was
old.
Yeah, whatever age she was. Anyway, when I got back, I felt like, you know what, it's time for a change.
A big change. She and her mom decided to buy a new home together.
I had people tell me, bad idea. Don't move in with your mom. You know, what if your mother gets very difficult? What if she gets into some really serious health problems? It's just not a smart thing to do. It's sort of against the cultural norm, I think, right now. But I think the cultural norm is shifting.
Wanda and Marie found a 3-bedroom house for $370,000 in Raleigh.
It wouldn't have been possible for either of us to purchase this property without pooling the resources. We each put $60,000 down.
Now they're the proud owners of a gray clapboard house with blue shutters and a front porch. But one of the best features of the home is the small cottage in the backyard, It has a two-bedroom apartment where Marie lives.
So this is really nice. I can just dash outside down these stairs. Hello? Mama?
Wanda and Marie looked at about 5 homes, but it didn't take long for them to decide this house had the perfect setup.
You know, we love each other, but probably we shouldn't be around 24/7. One issue we've sometimes had is mother used to be in control, and she now feels that I'm in control, which is true. And so there's sometimes little power struggles.
But they do spend quite a bit of quality time together. Wanda and Marie go swimming on some mornings, and they sit down every night for dinner with Wanda's 14-year-old son, Henry.
We girls have a meal at the table, and I have heard that many families do not. Mm-hmm. And so we still have this ritual.
It certainly helps conversation-wise to have more than 2 people because, you know, I couldn't chime in with witty remarks if there's no one actually having a conversation.
As a single mom, the arrangement also takes some of the financial pressure off of Wanda. The two women divide the household expenses.
We split our bills. We split our mortgage payment at something like $860 a month each.
Wanda and Marie rarely disagree about financial matters. They're generous with one another, and they have similar philosophies about money.
I'm not a spender. I very rarely buy anything. You know, stores hate me.
But they don't always see eye to eye when it comes to cleaning and clutter.
She cooks. I don't.
She doesn't even clean up, but she does carry her plate out to the kitchen.
Henry does his part, too. He gets a weekly allowance of $15, but he works for it. Among other things, he cuts the grass, folds laundry, and provides tech support for his grandmother.
I go back there occasionally, only to make coffee or to teach her how to use her computer.
So how does a 14-year-old like living with his mother and octogenarian granny?
We don't always understand each other. My hair is blue.
Sometimes mother is more blunt and outspoken.
Well, I think both of us accept each other as we are. And I tell her, you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Lay off.
Since Wanda and Marie's home included the small cottage when they bought it, they didn't need to deal with any zoning laws. Not all communities allow second units. But experts say more cities and towns are beginning to. Michael Litchfield has written a book about turning one house into 2 homes. It's called In-Laws, Outlaws, and Granny Flats.
If you're thinking about creating an in-law unit, I think it's a good idea from the get-go to find out whether your town welcomes them or not. Once you start doing certain things like adding a kitchen, then it has the potential to become a second dwelling, and zoning does have opinions about that.
If you do get past all of the zoning rules, Wanda Urbanska said there can be many advantages to moving in with family.
It's a smart arrangement financially and in other ways. Mm-hmm. But I think both parties have to come into it with open eyes. I think people have, in our country, been sort of more afraid of what they were going to lose, you know, like freedom, independence, rather than looking at the benefits to being close to an elderly parent, you know, in their final years.
And Marie, what sort of advice would you give to other families who are considering moving in together?
You have to be open to change. And it's difficult, but it's very rewarding. It's much better than being alone with a cat, nice as cats are.
In Raleigh, North Carolina, I'm Tara Siegel-Bernard for Marketplace Money.
And now we turn to the Times wealth columnist, Paul Sullivan, to talk about the oldest and largest federal tax deduction, one that for many homeowners helps represent the American dream. It's the mortgage interest deduction, and it is on the chopping block once again. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Tess. Thanks for having me here.
Let's start with just a brief explanation of what the mortgage interest deduction is for those who do not have one.
It's a rebate, essentially, that the federal government gives you for not only owning a house, but owning a house and itemizing your taxes. And so essentially, whatever interest you're paying on that loan is tax deductible based on your level of income. And it's now become a real, you know, sacred cow, third rail. I mean, pick your political cliche. I mean, there's a strong lobby to keep it going, and a lot of people really love it.
Well, and as a homeowner, I have to say I'd be part of that lobby.
Yeah, I'm a homeowner too, but, you know, I have a sense of fairness. And look, I'm not going to say please take away my mortgage interest deduction, but I do see where we're favoring homeowners over renters. And more than that, we're favoring homeowners who itemize their tax deduction over people who just file it straight. And the reason is research has been done that says only about a quarter of all homeowners benefit from this. And, you know, lower income people don't benefit for the most part because they don't itemize. Older homeowners don't benefit because for the most part, many of them have paid off their mortgages. And the people who benefit the most are wealthier people in the highest tax bracket who have the largest homes. And, you know, a lot of economists question whether we're incentivizing the right things anymore with the mortgage interest deduction.
Well, the argument that you hear is that this deduction helps to expand home ownership, that because of it, people will buy homes who would not otherwise. What does the data tell us about whether that's true?
It tells us that it's not exactly true. What it seems to have done over time is it's allowed people, instead of, you know, helping them buy that first home, which it has in some ways, but more often than not, it's allowed people to buy a larger home than they would buy otherwise, because they know they have this deduction coming. And, you know, as economists kind of look at this and see it cycle through, they've seen that, you know, it's inflated prices. It becomes an what they call an unproductive tax because it ties up all this capital in a home. Because, you know, you're a homeowner, I'm a homeowner. You don't just pay your mortgage every month. You don't just pay your taxes. Things break in a house. So you have an even bigger house than you would otherwise. You're paying a lot more in expenses to keep that house running. And that's money that could go to something else in the economy.
Well, then let's talk about what would happen if this deduction were to be cut or eliminated altogether. What does the economy look like without a mortgage interest tax deduction?
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, nobody I talked to would actually go on the record as saying, oh, yes, we can see this deduction being eliminated. And that's because the real estate lobby is quite strong, and they've done surveys that show that people who are renters who may never even own a home still want this deduction in place out of a sense of fairness. They aspire to having it one day. But the housing market's already weak. The immediate thing that happens is that prices go down because this deduction has been factored in. So what does this do? Well, it really hurts people who own a house because if they plan to sell it, until the market sorts itself out, they're just going to lose a tremendous amount of value in their home. The second thing that happens is even if they don't sell it, their taxes are going to go up. But there is a group who would benefit from this tremendously, and that's people looking to buy a home. So they may not have that deduction, but you know the prices are going to come down. The toughest part to predict in this whole debate is what would really happen if the deduction were cut. It's just uncertain as to what would exactly happen.
Tough to answer, but didn't stop me from asking you. Paul Sullivan is the Wealth Matters columnist for the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tess.
I've been footing the bill for some time, stretching my credit out of line. Well, I may not get ahead, but now I won't be far behind. I've got one more payment, and it's fine. We're gonna swing it.
We talked earlier with a couple who decided not to walk away from their mortgage despite owing more than their property is worth. But for tens of thousands of people, the American dream of home ownership ended when they handed the keys over to the bank and said goodbye. There have been dire warnings about financial lives crashing and burning for years on end after homeowners walk away. We wondered what the reality looks like.
I might play something that's appropriate to the occasion.
John Wittenberg is 42 years old. He walked away from his condo a year and a half ago.
It cries, but still's a gnashing, yeah.
This old house of ours was built on dream. And a businessman don't know what that means. There's a garden that she works on every day. And tomorrow morning, the man from the bank's gonna come and take it all away.
In the middle part of the last decade, the pharmaceutical company Wittenberg worked for moved him from Boulder, Colorado to Agoura Hills, California.
There was a lot of pressure at the time to buy houses in Southern California. Everybody was making tons of money,
And my company had a relocation expert who said to me, I'm almost going to have to insist that you buy a property. So I did. I bought a fixer-upper for $450,000 in April of 2006.
Wittenberg put 20% down on a 30-year fixed mortgage and spruced up the two-story condo himself. A year and a half later, he was laid off. He got a new job with a renewable energy company in San Francisco, so he turned the condo into a rental and headed north. But tenants kept demanding lower and lower rents until he had a shortfall of more than $1,000 between the rental income and his mortgage payment. And by 2009, comparable homes in Agoura were selling for almost $100,000 less than what he owed on the property. He tried to get the bank to modify his loan to no avail. So with the help of a company called YouWalkAway.com, he stopped paying his mortgage.
We looked at how much my home was underwater, how much money I've lost thus far, and how much money I will continue to lose until I start to break even. That could be 20 years away. I mean, it's not going to recover that quickly. It was a no-brainer. It became a business decision.
YouWalkAway.com's chief executive, John Maddox, says that's how it should be, a no-brainer for the 11 million people who are underwater on their mortgages.
A lot of our clients are people who've never been laid on anything in their life, and now it's this massive thing that they're going to default on, and it goes against everything they've ever known. But I think as more and more people know someone that's done it, it's something that people are accepting.
John Wittenberg knew that a default on his home loan could spell doom for his credit score, which he says was in the low to mid 700s. The bigger question was what would happen to the rest of his financial life.
Am I going to have to pay this back? What are these banks capable of doing to me? So here I am. You know, I'm probably upper middle class. I have 2 degrees, and here I am. I'm stuck.
He won't have to pay it back because California is what's called a non-recourse state. The bank cannot come after mortgage holders when they walk away. As for his credit score, Fair Isaac released a study earlier this year showing the average FICO score drops around 100 points in a foreclosure, which is how walkaways are classified. The bigger surprise, according to YouWalkAway.com, is that many of its clients are finding their scores begin to recover within a few months. The impact so far for Wittenberg? Well, there hasn't been any. He lives in his girlfriend's house north of San Francisco, so he didn't have to worry about a landlord checking his credit. And he says he's done with debt forever.
I don't have a credit card. I don't have a car payment. I don't have anything. I live in a cash world, and I want to keep it that way, you know?
That's not to say he hasn't paid a price. He lost his entire down payment and drained a significant portion of his savings account to make up for that monthly rental shortfall. But he hasn't checked his FICO score, and he doesn't want or intend to. What saddens him most is the loss of the condo he would have held on to but for the math.
There is a pride of ownership. It's nice to own your own castle.
And it may be quite some time before he is a king again.
Okay. So I'm doing my FICO score.
Okay. 600 miles north in the rural community of Wilsonville, Oregon, 50-year-old Bill Sawyer sits at a laptop in his apartment, punching in his social security number at myfico.com.
Okay, so we got to type in a profile here.
I promise I won't watch your social security number.
Okay. You can take my credit if you like, and I don't know if you'd want my identity.
Last he knew, as of a couple of years ago, his credit score was in the low 700s. But that was before he walked away from a small townhouse in nearby West Lynn. He bought it a decade ago for $138,000. Over the next few years, its appraised value nearly doubled, and the bank let him borrow money twice against the house.
They just crunch the numbers like a car salesman might, you know. Then you sign the dotted line, well, this is what I need to pay every month, and this is what I get.
Sawyer, who works as an operations and policy analyst for the state, used the money to pay down other debts, including credit cards and a car loan. Then in 2007, tragedy struck. His 18-year-old son Daniel was killed in an auto accident. Aside from the emotional and psychological devastation, the accident sent Bill Sawyer into a financial tailspin.
There were some financial hardships. It kind of started as a chain reaction, you know, with a maxed out credit card and a line of credit through my bank. And when you have a limited income and you make minimum payments, you know, that debt just keeps going.
Then on top of everything, the housing market collapsed and he owed more than his home was worth. He tried to negotiate for a loan modification. And after that fruitless effort, he abandoned the property in March of this year, also with the help of YouWalkAway. But he had not wanted to check what that has done to his credit scores.
I'm holding on tight. Oh, my gosh. Never has it been that low. TransUnion 535, Equifax 520.
Are you surprised?
I'm not shocked by it, no, but it's, you know, it hurts. You work your whole life establishing a reputation with your credit. Pretty much start over from the bottom of the barrel now.
It's not the bottom of the barrel, but it is close. And it was made worse by a bankruptcy filing over the summer. Sawyer made sure to get his current apartment before moving out of the townhouse, just in case landlords were scared away by a low score. But if he ever has to move, he knows the walk away could make everything more difficult. For now, he feels relief.
We were happy in that home. I didn't see any other way to resolve this matter without pretty much putting money down the drain for years to come. I made the decision.
And it was the best decision, he says, for him and his 23-year-old daughter, Vanessa, who lives with Sawyer. His financial recovery appears to have started already. Sawyer was approved last month for a $300 limit credit card through Capital One, which he plans to pay off each month in an effort to repair his score.
I'm not looking at buying another house, probably ever. I'm going to live within my means and kind of start from scratch.
The key is that he was able to start from scratch.
They'll sell your farm right under your feet, put you and your family out on the street. Then you've got the foreclosure blues. You're out on the street with low-down blues. Holes in your pocket, holes in your shoes. You got those foreclosure blues.
This is Marketplace Money from APM American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. And we continue this special hour in partnership with the New York Times called Which Way Home? As we explore where housing fits into today's American dream. For the past 2 years, California homeowner Althea Blakey has been trying to get a loan modification on her mortgage. She bought her East Palo Alto home more than 30 years ago for less than $18,000. But after refinancing several times, she ended up owing more than $265,000. Ann Carnes is the lead blogger for the Times Bucks blog and reported this story. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us, first of all, just a little bit about Althea.
She's 59 years old. She has a small home in East Palo Alto that she bought, well, more than 30 years ago. She was a young single mother at the time, and she was able to save up a little bit of a down payment and bought the house.
And I think we have a clip of her talking about the importance of this home in her life. So let's listen to that.
We had lots of birthday parties. We have lots of barbecues on the patio. Yeah, this house was always filled with love.
Oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. So when did she start pulling money out of that home?
She said that over the years, she did several refinancings. The most recent one that led to her current loan modification was in 2007.
I was off from work for a year, like 7 years ago. And we wind up using credit cards.
She had got into a little bit of trouble with credit card debt. Her husband's business wasn't doing well. And she refinanced, and the end result was that she got a loan for $265,000. And the monthly payment eventually proved more than she could handle.
All right, well, let's hear what she had to say about all this refinancing.
I wish I never had refinanced at all.
But it's amazing to think that your home, which started out at $17,000, mm-hmm. at one point it looked like it was worth almost $500,000.
People just wanted to get me in debt.
Oh, there you go. So all of this led to some difficulty for them in paying this new mortgage amount. And mm-hmm. at one point, they actually came close to losing their home. Let's hear how they described that.
Very anxious and very nervous.
Yeah, because you're waiting months and months and don't know what's going to happen. I'm like, oh, they're going to kick us out of our house.
All right, let's start from the beginning. When did she start looking for help with this mortgage, and describe that road for us?
She began looking for help in 2009, and ultimately nothing came of that. And so she decided to deal directly with Chase, which was her lender, and was offered a trial modification. But ultimately, that application was not made permanent. And it's unclear at this point what exactly happened. The bank has not weighed in yet with its side of things.
And of course, this is the story that we are hearing over and over again with loan mods, that it can absolutely take forever. But the reason we talked to them was because they ultimately have found success.
Correct. This is at the point when she really believed she was going to lose the house and was very stressed. And a friend of hers gave her this phone number for a nonprofit called Credibility. Ultimately, her modification was permanent as of October 1st, and they lowered the payment dramatically, I think to less than half of what it had been. And the interest rate was reduced to 2%, which she feels she can handle. She's employed. She's been employed for quite a while. Her situation job-wise seems steady.
And how are they feeling now about home ownership writ large?
They understand that they've made a trade-off, that their debt has been extended for a longer period of time than it would have been, but they feel very happy that they're able to stay in the house. She told me that she cherishes her little house.
Ann Carnes is a freelance writer and the lead blogger for the New York Times Bucks blog. Thank you so much for telling us Althea's story.
Thank you, Tess.
We've spent most of this hour asking whether home ownership is still a vital part of the American dream. Well, our next story shows that for plenty of people, it's still a huge part of that dream. Most commentary about the housing market focuses on Americans who've lost their homes or are struggling to hang on to them. But there are those who are taking advantage of the downturn to buy more houses. The Times wealth columnist Paul Sullivan is back with us. And Paul, are people really looking to purchase second homes as an investment these days?
Yeah, Florida, which is particularly fascinating to me, was, you know, ground zero for so many of the problems in the housing crash, is now really rebounding. Sales in Florida were up 10% statewide in September. But in Miami, one of the markets particularly hard hit, sales were up 46%.
Jeez. All right. Well, you went to Miami to talk with a woman who is doing just this, buying a second home. Here is a clip from Faggy Richmond.
After coming from New York, we thought, what a deal. This is like 1.5. If we move this to New York City, this was 1.5, and here we got it for $370,000. What a deal.
Well, as she kind of hinted, they do see this as an investment. Let's listen to her describing that.
It's just a different asset class. Instead of having money sitting wherever or investing, it's just another piece of something else that we think will go up in value.
So it sounds like they believe that the market there has bottomed out.
They do, but they also did something that a lot of people can't do and not enough people did during the boom, and that's they paid all cash for
Wow.
this condo. So they're literally looking at it as an investment, just as, you know, you'd buy stocks or bonds. They really are looking at it as appreciation. You know, in Miami, one of the local real estate groups there said that 63% of all sales in the past year have been all cash.
63%?
Yeah. Look, a $370,000 condo is nothing to sniff at. That's real money. But these are, you know, several million-dollar homes as well that are going all cash. So it's actually flipped the other way, where it's become more difficult for somebody who wants to buy a place to actually live in and needs a mortgage to do it. Mm. It's a lot more difficult for them to get that dream property.
But Paul, this sounds awfully familiar, this notion that the asset is going to go up.
I mean, there's a skeptic in the story who, you know, expresses very clearly that, hey, this is a consumption asset. It may not go up. And, you know, think of it in those terms. Enjoy it, and maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. But we're getting back to that 2006 mentality if we think all real estate goes up.
Paul, what do you think this story tells us about the place of housing now in the American dream? I mean, you know, that's what we're really looking at here. And boy, you have this increase in people who are now buying second homes. That's kind of opposite from what we hear in the rest of the housing market.
Sure. I mean, I think it tells us that we as Americans are incredibly optimistic and that we love the idea of owning something, owning a home. And, you know, you're getting to enjoy an asset while you, you know, hopefully watch your money grow. And it's, you know, you can't enjoy a stock, you can't enjoy a bond, you can at least flee to Miami Beach in the winter. So if they're right, they've made a very rational choice. If they're wrong, I think many of them are hedging that, you know, the second home market is been so beaten up, particularly in places like Miami Beach, that they'll at least be able to get their money out in a couple of years and will have, you know, enjoyed it along the way.
Paul Sullivan, thank you.
Thanks, Tess.
And for our final story of this hour, we visit with a good friend of the program. Carl Richards is what we call the napkin drawing guy. You've also seen his work in the New York Times Bucks blog. He's a financial advisor in Park City, Utah, and loves using Sharpies to illustrate our brains on money. In one of his recent columns, Carl talked about how we all need to occupy our checkbooks, not just occupy Wall Street. In other words, take responsibility for our own financial mistakes and talk openly about them. Well, this week in the Times, Carl lived that advice. He wrote about an epic financial mistake he and his family made when they were living in Las Vegas. So we flew out to meet him there. Why are you telling this story? Certainly, you must be...
That's a damn good question.
Yeah. I mean, you have clients who are going to hear it, who are going to read it in the Times, and potentially wonder about your judgment as a financial advisor.
Financial decisions are complex. What we've learned from it, at least, is to be a little bit slower to judge other people's decisions. Nobody's immune from making these mistakes.
Carl is 39, tall, athletic, and hair-free. His wife, Corey, is 41, a petite blonde and full-time mother to their four kids, ages 6 to 14. We all know now that in the middle part of the last decade, gambling in Las Vegas was not restricted to casinos. Going all in on a house was as sure a bet as you could find. For the Richards, the bet centered on a 3,500-square-foot home bought 8 years ago in a gated community west of Las Vegas. We talked on the street across from the house as Corey explained why we weren't inside.
I loved the house and we had good memories there, but a little hard to see that it's not ours anymore.
Last year, they lost the home in a short sale. You know this story. It's been told thousands of times over the last few years, but not often by a financial professional who manages other people's money.
When we first moved down here, we were both convinced that it was had already been too hot to buy, so we originally leased a home. And then within a couple of months, there was this sense of, if we didn't buy, we would never be able to afford a house.
You were a financial advisor, but you looked at what was going on here and no alarm bells for you?
I think we both remember feeling like it just felt a little crazy, but at the same time, everywhere you looked, there was sort of reinforcement that you need to be sort of on this train, you know, or you may never get on.
I think more than the feeling of alarm, it was the feeling of excitement, of it's growing, there's more, hurry, get in.
The house cost $575,000, and they put no down payment on it. Within a year, they refinanced and tapped their skyrocketing equity to help Carl start his own business. Then, in late 2008, early 2009, the stock market turned. His business started to slow, and they could no longer tap their equity.
Nobody anticipated sort of this drop. And in fact, you didn't really want to know. It was just sort of this classic idea of, like, you know, not wanting to accept the party coming to an end.
You think you were deluding yourself at that point?
I think there was a lot of deluding ourselves. I mean, of course. I mean, you want to continue to believe that things are going to be okay.
But they weren't. The Richards had to sell their second car. They took all four kids out of any extracurricular activities that cost money. Carl moved out of his office and stopped funding their retirement accounts. They decided to leave Las Vegas and move to Park City, where 95% of Carl's clients live. But because of all the money they'd borrowed from Phantom Equity, the house was $200,000 underwater. A friend who worked in real estate suggested they try for a short sale, and that the first step was to stop making mortgage payments.
Wait, what do you mean, miss payments? Right, like, don't I have a ethical... He said, no, you're confused, right? You don't have an ethical or moral obligation to the bank. You have a contractual obligation with the bank. You have a moral obligation to your family. You're putting at risk your business, your income. You've already spent all your savings. You're using credit cards now, all to fulfill this obligation you think you have to the bank.
Why do you think you felt that it was a moral issue? And you certainly were not alone in that. I mean, that's the big sticking point for a lot of people in this country. They feel there is a moral obligation, that it's the biggest payment you probably have in your life, and you owe it.
I mean, it's certainly a societal belief, right, that you pay your debts. I have this theory that maybe it's even a genetic thing with my grandfather, or certainly my great-great-grandfather, when he borrowed money to buy a farm, that generation borrowed money. They probably borrowed from their neighbor who was a banker. Right? They looked the banker in the eyes, and they shook hands and said, my word is my bond. And they made a commitment to repay that loan. I think that's sort of the sense that we all feel, is that this is some sort of my word is my bond, ethical obligation to repay a loan. When in reality, it's a contract between two willing parties who should both understand the risk they're taking.
What ended up happening?
Yeah, we stopped making mortgage payments. We went through the modification process. That didn't work. We had to relocate. So about that same time, Wachovia instituted a new short sale program.
So what did you end up having forgiven? How much money did the bank leave on the table?
A lot. More than $200,000.
Well, Carl, the question, of course, for you in any listener's mind is going to be, you're a finance professional. How did you get yourself into this kind of situation?
Yeah, no, that's a fair question. I mean, it's making the same sort of classic mistakes everybody makes. If you think about how fast things were growing, right? The value of the house is growing dramatically. My income's growing dramatically. And we all have this tendency to base the future on a relatively recent past, right? So we project that into the future. And when you project that into the future, we had no problems. And then the next mistake we made is not realizing that things change. When we think back, like particularly when we think back to the emotion of it, I mean, it was crushing. I think, at least to me, it's helpful to know there's a way out of that mistake and that you can, look, we make mistakes. We can either sit around and complain and whine about the big, bad, mean people who got us here, big, bad, mean banks, or we can choose to make a plan, right, get out of this mistake and hopefully create a better future for ourselves.
Who do you blame?
It's 100% clear that we're to blame. Right? I mean, we made these decisions. We have a firm belief that we are personally responsible for our financial situation, and there's no one to blame but us.
You know, there are going to be a lot of people who hear your story and read your story and will be angry that you just walked away from this commitment that you made. What do you say to that sentiment?
I think that's a really tough question to answer. What I've certainly learned from this experience, if I didn't know it already, is there's two sides to every argument. We didn't get away with anything. We paid the price. It would be ethically and morally irresponsible to break a contract and not suffer the consequences spelled out in the contract. The consequence is we lost our home. We lost our credit, and we also left with nothing, negative net worth. And again, I'm not saying this for anybody to feel sorry for me. I'm just trying to explain that it wasn't like we got away with anything. And then on top of that, it's an interesting societal price we're paying. Because even though this is a common occurrence, people still don't. I mean, it's a pretty heated subject.
Do you still, after all this, see home ownership as part of your American dream? Do you want to own a home again?
I do, very much so. To me, I guess it's kind of a safe place to be. It's a place where you can nurture your children and they can always come home to.
Carl?
Me too. But my thinking about home ownership's totally changed in terms of its role in a financial plan. I mean, I think, look, a home's where you live. It's not an investment. It's a place you live. And so my view now is, like, I hope the next home we buy is the place we're there for a long, long, long time. I'm not thinking of it as part of the balance sheet.
Carl and Corey Richards, thank you.
Thanks, Tess.
Thank you, Tess.
I guess. I'm just kidding.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this housing special, so please write to us at marketplace.org. And don't forget to friend us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Special thanks this week to our collaborators at the New York Times, especially our good friend Ron Lieber. This special hour of Marketplace Money was produced by Devin Maverick Robbins and John Haas. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.